Greetings, this is Will Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is John Kimmy of Santa Fe, New Mexico. In 1968, John co-founded the Santa Fe Community School, and while living there, he became acquainted with the elders of the Hopi village of Holta Villa in Arizona. John got along well with the village leader, Grandfather David, became a student and a traveling companion of that late Hopi prophet. The Hopi elders urged him to found an organization to collect and conserve native food crops of the Southwest. And before his passing, Grandfather David also asked John to continue making available the Hopi story to those who are interested. Today, John has kindly agreed to speak with us about the synergy of the heart, corn seeds, and song. Welcome, John.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be on your program.
Tell us about Grandfather David. What was he like?
Oh, he was perhaps the most important person in my life. David Manongyo was the leader of the Hopi village of Holta Villa that was the last stronghold of the traditional way of life at Hopi. He and his fellow elders, in their 80s and 90s when I met them in 1975, formed a resistance to all the incursions to the traditional lifestyle, which were including the Hopi Tribal Council, the Mormon Church, the Peabody Coal Company, the BIA schools, and various other influences that had on the younger generation that was creating doubt about the importance of the tradition. David was a living symbol. He was the last living spokesman of the Hopi prophecy, which was authorized for release to the public in 1945. He was well known around the world for responding to the request to deliver the 3-hour oral delivery of the prophecy. I often traveled with him, and when he did this work, and finally he became so blind and physically frail that he couldn't travel anymore, and he asked me to take over the task. I've been delivering prophecy for about 30 years now myself.
All right.
Elders were master farmers, and I was privileged to be able to work in their fields with them for many years.
And you learned that the Hopi corn seeds are unique. What can you tell us about them?
It isn't just the corn. It was corn, beans, squash, melons, fruits, everything that adapted to that climate and conditions out there. Hopi land is a desert with no irrigation, and the soil is sand. Their crops are totally unique. They're no more drought-resistant crops anywhere in the world. I've researched that and found that to be the case. In fact, when we had our seed company, we were sending relief Hopi crops to Africa during Ethiopia during the height of their drought, and it was the only thing that grew during those times, and they're still growing blue corn out there, I understand, to anticipate further droughts.
And tell us about the planting technique you used with that corn.
Well, the thing about this corn and all the other crops is that the Hopis must continue conducting ceremonies in an annual cycle, which is unbroken for 5,000 years. Their prayers track the rain clouds, and this is the only irrigation. Hopi corn is distinguished as the only variety of maize with a tap root. The seed can be planted 20 inches deep, and often is, if that's where the moisture level is in the spring planting time. If that level's not replenished by the spring rains and drops even further, a root will follow that level as much as 20 inches more. That's why it's planted with a long planting stick to make the channel deep enough to be able to get the corn to where the moisture level is.
Tell us about when you awoke in the heat of the day and walked down a trail off the mesa into an arroyo where you'd never been before.
Well, that was quite a surprise for me because I've been out there for years, and I've even worked in some fields out there at that point. This was a year when by mid-July there had been 6 weeks of no rain. And almost everybody's corn had, come up originally when it was planted at the moisture level, but without any further rain, what had come out of the ground was just crisp and no longer alive. And people were pretty depressed, and it was really hot in the daytime, and it was one of those hot days, and everybody was kind of siestaing after lunch, and for some reason I got curious and just took off and walked down the mesa and down a trail I'd never gone before, and ended up coming upon this field that was a vast field of corn, and it was all still green and growing. And I looked at the ground, and it was just as parched as everywhere else. I was wondering what had happened, so I started walking down toward it, and as I got close enough, I started hearing a man's voice singing. And I walked down the rows until I spied the source of the song, and it was one of the elders that Grandfather David knew. And he was standing at attention at each of his plants and singing a particular song and going from plant to plant. I was pretty amazed at all that. And when I got back to David's place, he was wondering where I'd been. And he said, where have you been? I said, well, I told him the story. And I said, I can't believe that he's got corn growing when everybody else's is parched. What's the deal? He said, oh, he says, you must have seen Titus's field. He says, Titus is still one of the only ones left around here that still sings to his corn at a time of drought. And I said, well, what does that do? He said, well, you know, he says, we consider those our children, our food plants are all our children, and we have this obligation to encourage them and keep them going as much as possible. And since we don't have irrigation, and when it doesn't rain, we have to get out there and encourage them. And so these songs are to encourage them and to inspire them to stay alive until the next rain. I said, well, that's wonderful. I said, how come all these other farmers aren't singing to their corn? Theirs are all dead. He said, oh, he says, they could sing to it, but it wouldn't do any good. And I said, why? He said, because their corn has been planted for many years without anybody ever singing to it. And so the corn itself wouldn't even know how to respond. And that was a real lesson for me about the relationship, what the Hopi people call their one-legged relatives, the plant kingdom, and how closely they are related to the people who grow it. And how important it is that one's family's food be perpetuated from generation to generation, just as you would the children of every generation.
And then you told me that Grandfather David had something to show you.
Yeah, anyway, he said, as a matter of fact, he says, I've got some corn back here, just a minute. He went back in the back and opened his trunk and came out with his cloth sack of blue corn. And he said, this is my own corn. He says, this is the last time I planted it, I've always sung to it up until this last time I planted it. And he says, so it's singing corn, just like Titus's. He says, I'm going to give you this corn. He says, I'm blind now, and I can't go out and grow it. He says, but I will give you this corn just so you'll get to know it. I'm going to give you an experiment to do. And I said, what's that? He says, well, I says, I want you to plant part of it in one field and part of it in another field, but the fields have to be separated from each other, out of earshot of each other. And I said, and why is that? And he said, because one of them you're going to sing to. So I pitched my teepee next to the one that I was going to sing to, and every morning I'd get up with my drum and I'd go out and I'd sing the sun up with this planting song that I had been given, actually a Quechua song that I'd been given by someone who worked with the Quechua Indians down in Peru and Bolivia. As it turned out, I treated each of the fields exactly the same, except the singing to one of them. My crop came in 2 weeks early with the singing corn, and it was had more ears per stalk and longer ears. As I harvested it and looked at the kernels, the kernels on the sungtu corn had turned a kind of purple color, and the other was still this kind of dull gray that was the original corn that I put in the ground. So I went back to David, and I said, well, I finished the experiment, and he said, how'd it come out? I said, well, I said, told him about how it was accelerated in its growth and in the volume of corn that came off it. And then I said, but the main thing I'm curious about is, I said, the one I sang to turned purple, and the other was still the kind of gray-blue. And he kind of laughed, and he says, well, don't you know what purple is? And I said, what? He says, that's the color of transformation. He says, that means that it has caught up all the years that it's been sitting in my trunk that hasn't been planted. He said, it caught up to new conditions and a new way of life that is ready for the future. If you were to plant both of those next year, you would find out that the vitality and the speed of growth and everything of the purple corn would again exceed the other corn, because it was living in the modern time and was happy to be there.
So the corn seeds brought current by the singing, and in your case, your singing. So singing corn is ready for planting next spring.
Well, definitely. I mean, any corn seed that's viable is, and in this dry climate, you know, archaeologists have found corn seed in pots that has been buried for hundreds of years in a cave is still germinable because of our dry conditions. Yeah, the preparation for replanting is heightened by the intention of the planter, for sure. And in most indigenous countries that grow corn all over the Americas, for instance, the singing at planting time is a part of the process.
So the voice, the song of a one-hearted human, in a way fertilizes the corn, but it's more than fertilization, obviously, because the color changed.
Yeah. Yeah, like he says, you know, it's kind of an encouragement to enter into the future. You know, it's kind of like when we raise our children and we tell them stories and sing songs to them that are going to inspire them to want to grow up and be part of the future.
Yes. But it's doubtful that a two-hearted human would have the same effect on a corn seed. Did you ever do that experiment?
No, that would be interesting to do, but I do know that if you don't have a communion with Mother Earth, that it's pretty hard to be a farmer. You know, there's a lot of people that start gardening and they say, oh, I got a black thumb, I can't grow anything.
Right.
And it's not because of their thumb, it's because of their attitude toward Mother Earth.
So help our listeners understand the difference between the one-hearted and the two-hearted path so they can appreciate why a two-hearted being singing the same words might lack the potency to blend with the seeds and create singing corn.
Well, the way it was told to me is that one-hearted are those who maintain their communion with Great Spirit. It was the original intention of the Creator to provide each life form with a path to be in harmony with every other life form. Grandfather used to say, you know, isn't it amazing there are so many different life forms, even you look in a microscope and there's more in there. And now we think there's more in outer space, he says. But he says, that's not the real miracle. He says, the real miracle is that every life form has a unique path to follow, and that path is always harmonic with all the other paths and actually create a greater security by staying on their particular path. And that when human beings were created, we were given a path that was in harmony with the universe too. But we were also given this thing called a will, which allows us to say, yeah, but, and go off on some other direction. And all those who used the yeah, but clause and went off in some other direction have lost their communion with Father Sky and Mother Earth. And we should have an equal relationship with Father Sky and Mother Earth. You know, a lot of our modern religions, they get their instructions from Father Sky, but they've forgotten about the instructions from Mother Earth. And so we can have very religious people who are still abusing Mother Earth. And I think that's real important, you know, that we we realize that our leadership is perfect. Father Sky and Mother Earth will never lead us astray if we're in correct communion with them. If we choose to follow other leaders, like just our minds, if we think that there is no leadership in Father Sky and Mother Earth, then we're stuck with just our minds, which are pretty easily confused and very imperfect. Or we follow somebody like priests or scientists or politicians, and we believe that they're going to lead us in the right direction, and we all know that's it.
Yeah, we're getting a good example of that right now, aren't we?
Yeah.
So this story is relevant for us today because we're at a fork in the road.
Very definitely. You know, the Hopi prophecy says that we've got to get back to the true path of life in their life plan, which is inscribed on a rock out at Araibi. It shows the two ways of life, the two-hearted path and the true path of life, and there's a little line between them that is the return path, where if you realize that you've been born and raised on the wrong path, that you can return to the true path. And that's what's been happening a lot in the last 40 or 50 years, ever since the atomic bomb, you know. It scared a lot of people into looking for another way of life because they realized that that one could be in the total annihilation. My generation, we looked for other spiritual paths, and some went to Eastern religions. Some went to Native American religions. I was one that first went to Native American religions, and now I've even adopted Buddhist practice. So it's all a way to get back to the true path of life.
And you said that the most important thing we could do at this point is begin to create circles of trust. Tell us a little bit about what you mean by that and how you would do it.
Well, I hope it's not too late. When I got my information about that, Spirit told me, blessed are those who are members of a circle of trust. And that is perhaps your family, perhaps your neighborhood, perhaps the people you work with, that you worship with. Anybody that can sit around together and make plans for the future and trust the results of those plans. You know, we now are kind of cut loose. We're on our own. This myth that the great white, can't even call him a great white brother in Washington anymore. But, you know, to look for that leadership and that security outside of ourselves is going to be disastrous. We've got to have enough experience, skills, knowledge, and willingness to create another way of life. And that's something you can't do as an individual that's competing with all other individuals. We have to do it as an us, as a collective. And whoever you have that is a circle of trust in your life, you should gather with them now and begin making your plans for the contingency. What happens if there's no money? You know, that was our God up until just a few weeks ago. Now we're finding out that that it's so fragile that there's a possibility it may not even be available. Does that mean the end of life, or does that mean the beginning of another way of life? And that beginning of another way of life has to be established through all of those abilities and skills and everything, which no individual solely has. We need to share all of that that we have so that we can come up with the best perspective to be able to survive and enjoy life.
And that circle of trust is a way to climb out of the vortex of confusion.
Definitely. It's the only way. You know, what the Hopi prophecy says is that in the future, all of the decisions have to be collective. You can't just go off on your own and say, well, I'm following God, the rest of you people are sinners. That's just plain foolishness. Now that we know that we are all tied together economically and that we are all in economic crisis, it demands that we come together as one people, and that one people, that coming together is not on the financial level first, it's on the spiritual level.
The heart level.
Once we have come together on that level, then we're going to know how to evolve out of the system that says that 4% of the population has 80% of the wealth.
Right.
And grandfather used to say, I would live to see the day when up was down, good was bad, right was wrong, and black was white. And we are definitely at that place now. And he said, when you see that, then the only way out of it is 180 degrees. What is the opposite of what is plaguing us? And so I started to look at that. And one of the things I looked at was our economics, which says, private enterprise says, I got mine, you go get yours. And if you take that and put the opposite to it, it comes out like something like, we're all gifts for each other. If we're all gifts for each other, we can take care of the needs of the world. If we get up every morning and see ourselves as resources rather than victims, then those suffering in the world are quickly going to be relieved by us eager ones who see ourselves as resources.
And when we do that work, it brings a joy and renewal that's really fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you can end your day and saying, I made a difference today. Somebody is better off because of my efforts today. Then you're going to live a longer life, and you're going to be living a life of joy and satisfaction. What more could we want?
So as long as you live, you're going to continue explaining the Hopi prophecy to interested people.
Well, as long as it's pertinent, as long as, you know, they say now that there's a possibility that all of this process of purification will be completed by December 21st, 2012. If that's the case, then I can retire after that.
Well, may we all be ready.
Yes, that is our prayer. And I just highly recommend that all your listeners take to heart what the ancients knew, because they had this understanding from the very beginning. Our ancestors, you know, when we say, oh, a Hopi prophecy, we're actually talking about a perspective that the Hopis are the last to have to keep alive in these modern times. But all our ancestors knew these things. And when you start to study these things, you'll find out that all of a sudden it's like remembering. Our very DNAs know this stuff. And if we just open up to it, it is accessible again. Grandfather David said, everything that has ever happened is recorded in Mother Earth. And when we need it, we can call on it. So I just highly recommend that people get back to their communion with Mother Earth. Go camping. Go mountain climbing. Go fishing. Take your kids out and go on a long hike for days and do those kind of things so that you get back in touch with Mother Earth, because she's going to have a lot of good instructions for us here in the near future.
Connecting the rhythm of my heart with the rhythm of the earth is always healing and renewal for me.
You know, they discovered that every living thing has a resonant frequency, and that they're all unique to whatever life form it is, but there's one particular resonant frequency that Mother Earth has. And there's only one other creature that has the identical resonant frequency. Guess who? Human beings.
And we have a choice. We can live in that resonance, or we can shift into the two-hearted path and become in a domination control behavior that takes us out of that resonance.
Yeah, and at this point, that's no longer a choice, because it's suicidal.
It is, and it's very widespread, because that behavior is fueled by fear.
Right, yeah. The only answer to fear is love. And if you can't bring yourself to love yourself, then don't expect to be able to love anything else.
And where we have enough power to do that is in our hearts. Our hearts are the most powerful part of our being.
That's right. In fact, the scientists say they've recently discovered that the flesh inside the human heart, that the cells and atoms have 85% the syntactical ability as brain cells, which is language. So there's an entire new language that's going to emerge from our hearts when we begin to come from there. And we'll all be able to understand each other, no matter what nationality or linguistic group we practice. We can all understand each other if we're speaking from our hearts.
And if we sing from our hearts, our right. seeds can benefit. But there's a subtlety there that you shared with us about the Hopi seeds, that there's something mysterious and magical that was imparted to those seeds by the ancients that we don't yet know how to do.
Well, and it's such a metaphor for our relationship with our own offspring, our children and grandchildren. You know, if we come from that place of stewardship and parenting in the true sense of the word, then our children will respond to that, and we will have another generation of compassionate parents. I think that's very important to remember about this. You know, if people want to learn more about the prophecy, they could go to my website.
Oh, good.
It's www.dancingawakethefifthworld.com.
Yes.
And that's the fifth is written out.
F-I-F-T-H.
Right. And there's a lot of information in there. And I would highly recommend that if anybody's interested in pursuing the one-hearted path, it's a good place to start.
Good. Thank you so much, John.
For sure, and thank you. It's been an honor to be on your program, and I hope that a lot of people get to hear it.
I hope so, too. This is Will Evans. I've been speaking with John Kimmy of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you for listening. This is KDNK. Stay tuned for Jim Hightower.